Hey, my name's Jamie Poisson, and I'm the host of Front Burner. It's the CBC's daily news podcast. And every day, we're discussing the big events and fault lines shaping Canada and the world. Politics, economics, social movements, you name it. Sometimes we even talk about really fun stuff, like the enduring relevance of Lord of the Rings. You can hear Front Burner on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
I'm Eleanor Wachtel, and this is Writers and Company. Today, from Johannesburg, South Africa, the internationally acclaimed artist William Kentridge. From charcoal drawings and sculptures to immersive videos, theater, and opera, his work engages with politics and memory. I used to think that William Kentridge was one of my own personal favorite artists, whether he was working in charcoal or directing an opera, making one of his unique smudged videos, or creating an utterly original theatrical performance, or even producing images in mosaics for the Naples subway. But then I discovered that he's the favorite living artist of almost everyone I know. And then there's the critical praise. His major exhibition last fall at London's Royal Academy was hailed as enthralling, an operatic epic, a show that never ceases to mesmerize. His current retrospective at LA's Broad Museum is described simply as extraordinary. William Kentridge insists that he became an artist almost by default. Had he not given up on careers in acting or TV set design, or, as he puts it, had he been a little less bad at them, South Africa would have missed out on its most renowned artist, and the whole world would be poorer for it. That's because Kentridge creates moving, powerful black and white drawings and remarkable animated films and works for the stage that make you feel the sadness, deprivation, and crimes of apartheid, but also South Africa's and humanity's potential for transformation and joy. William Kentridge was born in Johannesburg in 1955. His parents, themselves the children of Jewish immigrants from Lithuania, were both prominent anti-apartheid lawyers. His mother co-founded the Legal Resources Center, a human rights organization providing free legal services to the poor and marginalized of South Africa. His father worked on several high-profile cases, including the so-called treason trial, in which 156 people, including Nelson Mandela, were eventually acquitted. He also represented the family of black activist Steve Biko, who died in police custody. One of young William Kentridge's earliest memories is coming across some forensic photographs of the 1960 Sharpeville massacre in his father's study. This is when South African police fired on a crowd of black demonstrators, killing or wounding some 250 of them. But rather than fighting what he once described as an unnatural society using the law, Kentridge came to engage with its injustices and cruelties through his art. He began by making large-scale charcoal drawings, but in the late 1980s he made the jump to animated film, or what he called drawings for projection, filming as he creates them. He draws a bit, photographs it, then erases or alters the image, draws some more, and shoots a few more frames. In this way, images appear to move across the paper, but always leaving a kind of trace, a ghostly trail of memory and forgetting. He researches real events to question cultural or historical narratives. In one project called Ubu Tells the Truth, he combined testimonies from South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission with Alfred Jarry's 1896 play about the tyrant, King Ubu, who becomes an agent of the secret police during apartheid. In another, City Deep, he explores the relationship between South Africa's mining industry and the Johannesburg Art Gallery. While not necessarily brutal or violent in what it depicts, Kentridge's work is always a reflection of the divided and brutalized society that apartheid left in its wake. In 2018, he created a grand multidisciplinary work to commemorate the nearly 2 million African porters used by the British, French, and German colonizers during the First World War. The Head and the Load features music and movement, sculpture and shadow play, speech and pantomime to interrogate a hidden, fragmented history. One of Kentridge's most recent projects, conceived during lockdown, is a series of films about his life in the studio called Self-Portrait as a Coffee Pot. It had its world premiere at the Toronto International Film Festival last fall. William Kentridge spoke to me from the studio adjacent to his home in Johannesburg. I'd like to begin with charcoal, your preferred medium. If you imagine right now a thick stick of charcoal in your hand, intensely black, poised over a sheet of paper, what would happen next?
It's what happens before that is one of the questions. Because I think the drawing begins in the preamble to the drawing, in the pacing around the studio and gathering the energy for the moment when the charcoal hits the paper. So it's a slowed down version. When you're talking, one understands that there's a part of your brain that is anticipating the words that you're saying, it's getting them in the right order, correcting the grammar, and you only really know what you're saying as you see it. So one understands that this preliminary thought process before the words come out is a very quick but invisible process. So if one imagines that slowed down 30 times or 200 times, it's this walk around the studio gathering the fragments of thoughts and energy for the moment when the charcoal hits the paper, which is, I suppose, the second stage of the drawing. And then what happens is obviously this mixture between what your eye is seeing, what your muscle is doing, what your intention is, which is not the same as either of those two things, and then the conversation between the marks as they appear on the paper and yourself. And there's also a further stage. So you're close to the sheet of paper, your arm or your wrist or your fingers, your hand or your knuckles start making the mark, which is obviously connected to the first impulse. Here's a horizon line. We'll do a landscape. Here's a horizon line on it. Here's a piece of chamois leather which I can smudge the charcoal with if I want to. So that's very much being stuck in the middle of the drawing as it is being done. And then you take a step back, or a few steps back, to look at what you've done. And then you become a second person. You become a critic, the viewer of what you have been making, and give instructions back to the other self, the one who's drawing so badly, standing at the sheet of paper. So if you like, you've got the preamble, you've got the first marks, and you've got the review, sort of three stages.
Does your hand ever just take you places? I mean, surprise you?
Well, the marks surprise you. It's giving the image the benefit of the doubt. So you might say, right, here's the horizon, here's a rough series of marks, which then would suggest, oh, in fact, the horizon can shift, or here's a depression in the ground, or here's a dark shadow, maybe we make this section of it. But there's an impulse behind it. It's not surrealist automatic writing. It's not that saying, let's just do anything and see what emerges. It's neither a plan or a program. So it's in between the randomness of automatic writing or a chain of associations, but it's also not something planned. And that in-between space is where the drawing happens and where you have to be very open to what the drawing is doing.
You said that charcoal and paper should be enough to make a whole encyclopedia. What is it about this material that works so well for you?
Well, charcoal, you know, it's, on the one hand, it's a very basic material. It's a burnt piece of wood. But it's unlike graphite, which is chalk, pigment mixed with clay, which is quite hard and holds its pigment firmly. The charcoal is this dusting of carbon on the surface of the paper, and you can adjust it very easily. It's a very soft material, so you can wipe off the drawing you've done with a cloth or with an eraser if you want to use an eraser. But you can adjust it as quickly as you can think. It's not like oil paint where you've got to scrape it away or wait for it to dry and then paint on top of it. So the idea of an image having the potential to change is important, that it's provisional. The mark you make is provisional. Here is the mark on the sheet of paper. Oh, we're not happy with it. Let's change it. Let's see what it becomes. So in that sense, any thought or any sequence of thoughts are possible. And in that way, it's the ridiculous idea that you should make the encyclopedia with a charcoal and a piece of paper. But what it does make possible is understanding the world more as process than as fact.
You've worked in different media, in different art forms, even in different fields, from theater to cinema or opera, for example. But your first love, the form of expression that most suits you and the starting point of these other kinds of projects is drawing. It's the heart of the activity, you say. Why?
I think because it's the heart of the activity in showing a way of working. Not that every project actually starts physically with drawing, though most do, not all do. But with the drawing, when you're making the drawing, the process of making the drawing, the activity of making the drawing, is the process of discovering what the drawing is. So you start with a blank sheet of paper, and by the time the drawing is finished, there is a statement, there is the drawing that has been made. But it's not as if the drawing is made in advance. There isn't a storyboard and a script for the drawing, the way there would be for a piece of theater, for an opera, and for most cinema, most films or television. So what this does is you say, if you're working in an opera, to say, let me think of this opera as this drawing. At the end of the rehearsal period, and the end of the making, after whether it's 6 months of drawing at home or 8 weeks of rehearsing with singers, everybody will know exactly what they're going to do and where they will be. But we will allow this process to unfold the way we're drawing. In other words, if you ask me at the beginning, before we've started the rehearsal, where we should stand, what is actually going to happen in each scene, if I give you any answer, it will always be the wrong answer, because we need to allow the process to guide us also. So it's about the strategy of working in different mediums as if they were drawings, thinking of an opera as a four-dimensional drawing, rather than simply as a piece of theater.
And there's the fact that it's monochrome, black and white, charcoal is, which would apply as well to your more recent use of India ink. What's the appeal of that?
It's not so much what's the appeal of it, it's what is the incompetence when dealing with many colors. When I was working in oil paint, when I was working with colors, there's always a question, does this look right? Do these colors work? And that's a very bad question to ask yourself as an artist. The medium needs to be a material for thinking in. And I suppose the monochromatic charcoal or ink, for me, became a way of thinking. So there's fragments of color, there's found color. There's a lot of color in the theater productions, but that comes from the costume and set designer rather than from what I'm bringing to it. I suppose it has to do with a connection to black and white as the monochrome as the language of printing, whether that's text or engravings or lithography. It was certainly the form of seeing the world through photography for many decades. And so there's an affinity with that as a form, and that as both a limitation and a liberation. Not feeling one to be an artist, one has to work with oil paint on canvas. When I was a student, that was very much the expectation. If you were an artist, you might make some drawings, but fundamentally the artist worked with oil on canvas. It took a while to understand, no, that's a very particular, short and narrow and particular part of the world that saw that as the end point and the highest point of art making, but that for most of history and for most of the rest of the world, that is not the way of thinking about what it is to be an artist.
There are images that habitually appear in your work and others that you've never drawn. And in fact, you've made lists of them. Can you give me some examples?
I sort of at the beginning of I think it was at the beginning of COVID or the lockdown or at some point during that, I thought it's ridiculous. I've drawn so many rhinoceroses. I've drawn so many megaphones. I've drawn so many typewriters and telephones and high felt landscapes. And I said, okay, let me make a list of everything that I've drawn, every animal, every object, every circumstance, and then make a list of things that I've never drawn. I've never drawn Abraham Lincoln. I've never drawn a hippopotamus. I've never drawn a beef Wellington. I have drawn an Austrian dessert. I have drawn a portrait of Goethe. And I said, let me for a while say I'm only going to draw things from my secondary list, my list of things I've never drawn. But of course I realized that, in fact, I got stuck in that. I was more drawn to drawing the 200th rhinoceros than to drawing the first crocodile or hippopotamus. So there are things that you think it's random what the things are you're drawing, but there are certain There are certain objects and things in the world that meet the process of drawing halfway. So there's something about the mud-caked lines of a rhinoceros, as opposed to the smooth surface of a hippopotamus, that feel like they're already a drawing on the skin of the animal. There's something about the black bakelite of an old-fashioned telephone that meets the charcoal halfway, meets it on the surface of the drawing. There's something about the shine of the surface of a cell phone which doesn't call to me to be drawn. And so even if you're doing a drawing about the overabundance of communications we have in the world between email and phones and social media and the radio and all of these things, maybe an old-fashioned telephone is a better way, a better object to draw on the paper that can still talk about the same phenomenon.
Is it the sensual experience of the drawing? I mean, without getting too psychological, what do you make of those images that you return to that seem to call to be drawn?
Well, I think that, I mean, I think it's, you know, to be psychological in psychoanalytic terms, I think you'd say when they're overdetermined, when there's more enough and more than enough associations that flow out of them. So to take a rhinoceros, for example, we've got the fact that it's an extraordinary animal here, very close to Johannesburg. The fact that it became domesticated, and that things that one used to think of as wildlife in South Africa, the wild animals, in fact are in safe, protected areas. And what's much more dangerous are the humans all around. So there's that kind of association. There's another association of all the mining companies that have damaged so much of the land try to win back their good credibility through supporting wildlife funds and becoming conservationists. But there's also the echo backwards to the strangeness of the rhinoceros that Durer was drawing, or the rhinoceros at the carnival in Venice that Longhi painted, or Ionesco's rhinoceros. So there's an overabundance of different points of contact that it suggests. Its very strangeness makes it out of place in a ballroom. So it's a mixture. It's a mixture of something that in the associations of the image and in the pleasure of the actual drawing of it.
William Kentridge, you grew up in a very political household. Both your parents were prominent lawyers, active in the anti-apartheid movement. In fact, three of your grandparents were lawyers. What was it like to grow up in that kind of atmosphere in Johannesburg in the 1960s and 70s?
Well, of course, from the inside, childhoods feel normal. You assume that's what it is. But as I grew older, you know, it's the late years of primary school and then the years, obviously, of high school, it became aware that it was a kind of anomaly, that in terms of most of the other boys in the class, and remember, this was South Africa in the 1960s, this was an all-boys, all-white school, modeling itself on an English public school, if it could. But that for most of them, there was no questioning of the status quo. And so it was an anomaly to be in a family where the given was the injustice and the anomaly of South Africa in the world of nations. But otherwise, it felt like the extraordinary thing is how one naturalizes the circumstances that one is in. So that for many years, one would go to a public swimming pool and swim there. And only sort of the week after or 2 days after, suddenly they said, oh, swimming pools will not be segregated. And there were suddenly black children swimming in the same pools and things. You suddenly, that's insane. That's absurd. How could it not have stood out to me every day when I was there all those times before? So it's not something to be proud of, but it's a condition of how one absorbs the world around one. So in this, I was very lucky to be in a family and in a household where that was in general not accepted, not taken as natural, as the natural order of things.
What kinds of conversations took place around the dinner table? And were you encouraged to participate?
I was certainly encouraged. You know, certainly there were all the cases my parents were dealing with were discussed by them. I mean, they were interested in the things I was, you know, politely interested in the things I was interested at school, and I was certainly interested and fascinated by the different cases my father primarily would be describing or discussing. And I mainly remember my mother's rage at the quality and the venality of South African judges. as each, in almost all of the political cases, there were real rogues in charge of the courtroom. So it was kind of partly checking, was my mother actually going to explode, or would that be calmed down? My father would express his rage by rubbing his leg or stroking his nose or jiggling coins in his pocket. And then later on, when I was at university, or even before then, I would go to listen to some of the cases he was involved with. Particularly, I remember the Biko inquest, which was when I was just finishing university and studying at an art school. And I was aware that this was kind of remarkable. In retrospect now, all these years later, I think, my God, why wasn't I in the courtroom every day of those spectacular cases? But I certainly had a sense of them and of their importance, I think.
This was in 1978 when your father represented the family of the anti-apartheid activist Steve Biko, who died while in police detention.
Yeah, that is correct.
Yeah, and watching your father in the courtroom, was that a different man than at the table?
It wasn't such a different man, but it was a bit like knowing your father as an actor and then seeing him on stage, because he's on the stage of speaking out and being aware there's an audience behind him and to the court. But I think what made him so good at it was that the rage and the indignation was so deeply felt. It wasn't a performance of indignation. Or it was a performance of indignation on the back of real indignation.
For the benefit of the environment of the courtroom, you mean?
Well, for the benefit of the environment of the courtroom, for the benefit of the record of the case that was being made, for knowing that this would be kept as a record both of what he was saying, but also of the terrible things that the other side would be saying, or that the judge or magistrate might be saying. And in fact, that has been the case, that those were remembered, those performances and those activities and arguments and cross-examinations in courts are still strongly remembered, both as examples of what a lawyer can do and of the circumstances and history of those years.
You weren't drawn to the family business, you've said you needed to find...
No. It was not that I was not drawn to it. I realized that two things. One, I realized I'd never be able to compete with my father as a great lawyer. Secondly, I'd never know if I was a good or not good lawyer, because I'd never know if I'd done well because of what I'd done or because I was my father's son. And more importantly, I discovered that I needed... His cross-examinations were so acute that any opinion I might have would be demolished in two or three questions at the dinner table. So I think one of the reasons for being an artist was to find a language that was impervious to cross-examination, that could find a meaning in the world, but not using the same cold logic of legal argument. So it's not as if we're on different trajectories, but using very different languages and ways of looking at the world.
Was that a difficult thing to discover, to find a way of understanding the world?
No, I think it was... for years when I started as an artist and I was really struggling, I thought, this is not the right activity for me. Here I am stuck at being an artist when I really should have been a lawyer. And then after a while I understood, no, I'd be a very bad lawyer. I didn't have the rigor and the memory and the fidelity to facts that you need to be a good lawyer. And so... Being in the world of the imagination and of art, where the expectation is that you're going to be inventing the world, that you're going to be inventing images, circumstances, and that the world is there as raw material to be picked over by you, to be scavenged, then I realized it was very good that, in fact, I was in my field and not in my parents' field, and could feel a good connection to how I'd ended up as an artist rather than a resentment at not being a lawyer. And now every day I give thanks that I'm not the lawyer. I have a daughter who's a lawyer and a very good lawyer, and I think that jumping of a generation was good.
Your art has a polemical side, you say, but not in any clear-cut sense. You're interested in ambiguity or paradox. How does that work?
Well, it's saying things aren't stable the way you assume they are. So it makes for provisionality and uncertainty. Certainty outside in the world generally speaking, all statements of certainty have to be backed up by some authoritarian impulse. You find that people getting louder and louder as they try to proclaim their argument. Things which seem so certain in the political world shift and change. The Rainbow Nation, the miraculous transformation we had in 1994 in South Africa, becomes something very different 30 years down the track. So to be open to the fact, to understand that at the moment there are both optimistic futures unrolling and pessimistic futures, and both of those are unrolling at the same time, to hold on to that. So there's ambiguity and uncertainty, contradiction, but there's also the absurd, the way in which conventional logics aren't adequate to describing the world. Not the absurd as a joke, but the absurd as logic gone awry. And then this new strange illogic is followed through with great assiduity. And one can think of the whole apartheid system in South Africa as based on the illogic of deciding people's worth is based on their color of their skin or the curliness of their hair, and then building a whole system of laws and behavior and living on this false logic. And in that sense, there's an absurdity at the heart of it that one needs to keep track of.
Among other influences you've cited, there's also the data movement dating from the
Yes.
First World War. How is that important for you?
Well, there was a belief that good Western Cartesian logic, with its rational arguments, had provided all the background for this disaster of the First World War. And the Dadaists were saying, if this good logic has produced such catastrophe, let's rather look for some other logic, from some other way of working. So it was a resistance to the way the world was unfolding. If rational thought was so far from bringing enlightenment, maybe the irrational Dadaist poems of Kurt Schwitters and others could show the limits of language. So that's the one thing. The other is that before the Dadaists, if you were a visual artist, you made either a marble sculpture or a bronze sculpture or an oil painting or a charcoal drawing. But what the Dadaists did, and for them it was a failure that this was seen as art, was say, well, in the Café Voltaire tonight, this visual artist is going to be reciting this poem or playing this piece of music or getting dressed or doing nothing. Or, you know, today my painting will be a poem. Tomorrow my painting will be a dance. The next day it may be silence. The next day it may be finding a urinal and calling that my art object. So what they did 100 years ago, which we're still living through, is opened up enormously the world in which one could think of what it is to be an artist, to open the vocabulary and the mediums and the materials in a kind of completely different way to what was possible before. And so all the visual artists at work today are the beneficiaries and heirs of what the Dadaists made possible.
William Kentridge, you're interested in memory and how it works. And in fact, one could say that the processes of remembering and forgetting are enacted in your animation technique itself, something you've described as Stone Age filmmaking with its layers of drawing and then erasures and then redrawing. Can you talk about that, about how that form of animation evolved?
I think it's what I said, giving the image the benefit of the doubt and being led by it. When I started doing the charcoal animation, which, as you described, is not hundreds of different or thousands of different drawings like traditional Hollywood animation, but rather a few drawings which are reworked. So the two frames are shot in the camera, and then I would adjust the drawing either with erasing or with drawing further into it, and then shoot two more frames and go back to the drawing, an endless walk between the camera and the drawing. When I started doing this, I tried to get as good and clean an erasure as I could so that you had a clean drawing each time. You didn't have the history, the trace of what had happened. And at first I would apologize to people when I showed the film, saying, I'm sorry for the gray mess behind the drawing. I'm still trying to find the right eraser, an electric eraser, a different kind of paper. Until somebody else said to me, stop moaning and complaining. In fact, this trace of what has been there is the most interesting thing. And then I looked at it differently and I thought, oh, okay, yes, you're right. But then what that process or that result of the process enforced was a kind of thematic thinking. because what it made visible on the sheet of paper was the duration of time, the passage of time. You could see the ghost of someone as they walked across a landscape, not out of desire, but out of the technique itself. And so that made of necessity questions of time and questions of memory, which is obviously built into time, inherent in the project itself, and becomes willy-nilly part of the themes of the films, of not escaping one's past, of a trace of memory still being there, of having to do a kind of archaeological reconstruction of what the sponges could have been once the main image has been erased. And so I've always understood that the best things that I've done have not been things that I've planned, but which have either been pointed out to me or which I've seen in the work as it progresses.
And was animation a natural evolution of that drawing and erasing? And
the animation emerged. I was interested in thinking about the process of a drawing, because very often with a drawing, there's a kind of an energy at the beginning and the drawing would be going in a good direction. Then it gets, at a certain point, it gets overworked and then you wish you'd stopped it earlier and then you try to rescue it again and it can be a disaster. And I thought, let me film the process of drawing so I can catch the drawing at its, even if the drawing itself becomes a mess, in the record of it, I'll see when it was at its strongest. So it started as a record of watching a drawing coming into being, but then I realized when the drawing had come into being that you could continue filming and drawing and filming and drawing, and it would get a new life into it. So that was a discovery. And then many years later, I realized, in fact, when I looked through old home movies and things like that, there were many fragments of animation that I'd done with school friends, that I'd done myself when I was 12 or 13 or 14 years old. So there was something in animation which... although I guess, you know, a lot of kids, and now it's obviously so much easier, a lot of kids did, and now it's so much easier with the programs on the phone, you know, with time-lapse photography, with many simple programs, animation becomes a much easier activity. And I think, you know, there are now so many animation schools and projects and people doing animation, it's come out of the ghetto in a way into a much more mainstream position, both in the film and the art world.
Your work reflects a sense of history, not as absolute or objective, but rather as a kind of collage made up of fragments. How does that work?
Well, when you read a history, one's assumption is one reads it in a linear way in general. This is a series of events that happened. And what if it's well written gets elided is the way that that smooth narration of history is made up of so many details and pieces of research. This I found in this book, that I found in that archive, this oral history gave it to me, and it's turned into the seeming clear logic. What working in the studio does is you're very aware of the fragmentation and the putting together of fragments to make a provisional coherence. Because the fragments are so there, you're aware that it is not the history, but a possible narration of different events. So in a piece of theater like The Head and the Load, which is about African soldiers in the First World War, it's very clear on stage that it is made together of discontinuous fragments. And the test was, even with these discontinuous fragments, can a sense of the event be given, as well as making it clear how we construct a coherence in our head out of fragments. And in that, I suppose, the studio becomes a demonstration of how we are in the world. Things that are very natural and obvious in the studio can reveal things that are less obvious and more invisible outside in the world. So we are aware in the studio that we're taking many fragments, we're taking something from the world, we tear it into fragments, we rearrange those fragments and send that back out as a collage, as a drawing or a painting. And no one thinks that's strange, whereas it takes an act of real thinking and introspection or observing of others to think that this personality or that the storying I'm hearing, which seems so coherent, in fact is a construction, that we're not receiving the world, we're constructing it as we go through it.
Because you draw on real events to question cultural or historical narratives. As you mentioned, your theatrical production called The Head and the Load is a powerful critique of colonialism, described as part memorial, part provocation, recalling the enforced service of millions of Africans in the First World War. You said this project came about through discovering new historical material. What was that?
Well, the historical, I mean, one of the important starting points was frustration, my frustration at myself at not knowing this history when I should have, or at even knowing some of the history but being blind to it. So I'd known about the revolt in Nyasaland in 1915, and I even knew that it was connected to the First World War, but when thinking of the First World War, I was so always thinking of the trenches in France, All Quiet on the Western Front, 1917, the popular imagination of what the First World War is. And so that frustration at myself and that lack of knowledge, and in fact the lack of knowledge of all of us who are working on the project, some of whom had had grandparents and uncle, great uncles, or stories of their families of people who'd gone off to the African people who'd gone off to the war, was a shock. So each new piece of information, and there, I think over the last few years, there've been a lot of books which have come out about Africa in the First World War. Before that, all the military histories would have mentioned in passing that there were these huge number of African carriers carrying the war material across the continent, but the official war histories were very much about this regiment at this place and this battle and this skirmish. And that wasn't the way we worked. We started from a very different position. And in the end, it became a powerful piece about this history that we had no idea of when we started the whole project.
Shadows are a frequent motif in your work, and not just in your use of black and white, but also of large-scale shadow puppets and mechanical sculptures. And in fact, your current exhibition at the Broad Museum in Los Angeles is called In Praise of Shadows, as was the first of your Norton lectures at Harvard. What meaning does the shadow hold for you?
Well, the shadow, they're different things. When you see a shadow, you're aware of the limitation of what you're seeing. You know, if you see a photograph, for example, of an apple, you see its color, you see its roundness, its solidity, and you say, okay, there's an apple. When you just see its shadow, it's a slightly deformed circular shape. You have to be actively involved in interpreting it and saying, oh, there is the, I'm doing the work of saying, is it an apple? No, it's turned around. It's actually a knuckle pointing out. It's a fist. And if I look hard, that shadow, oh, it could be an old woman. That's her nose. That's her chin. The pleasure of shadows is this double vision of what it could be and what it might be and what you make of it. The other thing, of course, about shadows in theatre, but in general, is they're of you, but they're not of you. And so if you try to jump on someone else's shadow, to stand on the shadow under those circumstances, they are so much more agile. So it's both of you, but it's beyond you. So I'm interested in shadows that way. I'm interested in the way in which they can enlarge and shrink depending how close or far you are to the source of light. I'm aware also if you have a very bright light around, how it can be too bright to see by, and you need the shadow to see in order to see. So you think of that photographically. If you overexpose a photograph, it's only in the shadow areas that there's not too much light and you can see it. So there's a way in which you can have an illuminating shadow where you need the darkness in order to see, which one can play with in the studio as a kind of metaphor to being suspicious of the bright light of the Enlightenment.
Oh, that's, you just threw in a big metaphor.
Oh, okay. Well, take it or leave the metaphor.
I mean, the
Enlightenment, as we know, is our last best hope, but we know it also comes with so many things. We know that the political moment and era that corresponded to the Enlightenment is that of colonialism, both in the metaphoric sense of the claims of colonialism of bringing light to dark continents, of bringing enlightenment, but we're aware of the extraordinary damage that did, and so the limits of that colonial experiment. But on the other hand, the idea of a rational understanding of the world and making sense of it and democracy, it's still our last best hope. It's something we have to understand, the dark underbelly of Enlightenment history.
The other side of the shadow.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Caitlin Prest, and I am here in your ear to tell you about a very incredible new show called Asking for It. Asking for It is a darkly comedic series that follows a queer femme singer whose history of violence finds her no matter how many times she runs away. It has an original soundtrack, and it'll make you laugh, cry, and feel a little bit less alone. Asking for it. Subscribe now.
William Kentridge, one of your recent projects is a series of films, what you've described as a natural history of the studio, titled Self-Portrait as a Coffee Pot. The first three films were screened at the Toronto International Film Festival last fall. Why did you want to focus on this very personal place of creativity?
Well, the project, the Self-Portrait as a Coffee Pot, which was a series of nine films designed for streaming, specific for episodic streaming, so that you could watch one or two or have a gap to see them at your own pace, was my COVID lockdown project. So it started when everyone was locked down, and it was just in our bubble, in our house. There was my family, but also one studio assistant who lived in the cottage at the back of the house. So I decided this would be a calm time to start a project which I'd wanted to do, of examining what happens in the studio. What are the metaphors? What are the processes? What are the ways of understanding that world come from the studio? So the form of the series was given by the conditions at the beginning, which was alone in the studio, making a drawing and talking about it. And I split myself in two so I could have a conversation and not just a monologue. So I'd film myself twice in conversation and then edit them together. And then as the 18 months or 2 years of making the film progressed, gradually the lockdown eased, and so more collaborators could come into the studio, but it still kept the form of the claustrophobic single room of the studio in which everything happens. The studio also is a kind of metaphor for the brain, of the different thoughts shifting across one's head, the way one moves between different drawings or different objects in the studio. So it is about the studio, but in the studio many other things are looked at, questions of utopia, questions of colonialism, questions of language and sense and translation, questions of one's place in the world through looking at landscape, questions of who one is through looking at self-portraiture. So they're all set in the studio, but they use the studio as a way of looking at other things too, I hope.
You've described your studio as both a physical space and a psychic or metaphoric one. How so?
So it's a physical space in that it's got walls in which you can pin things up. As soon as you've finished a drawing or while you're working on it, you can pin it. It's got a rig to put a camera on. It's got all the material, the infrastructure of a studio, the drawers of materials, the objects that I like to have close at hand. So it's very much a physical space in which I can walk around, which is mine, but also a space in which is a safe space for stupidity. So that's physical also, in the sense I can close the doors and I can put a camera and act the idiot in front of the camera and no one is watching except myself or the camera. But it also means it becomes a place of thinking that is protected. But also it's metaphoric in the sense of how does one understand the world? Not in the studio, in one's head. One takes all these fragments every day, as we all do, whether it's things we read, the newspaper, or the newspaper on our phone, or the phone calls, or the emails, all the different ways the things we're seeing as we go through the street, the story someone tells us, all these fragments which come into us, which we rearrange into some sort of coherence in our head and present ourselves to the world as a coherent being when we can. And getting ready to do the drawing, I'm doing this physical walk around the studio, which is there's a kind of peripheral vision of all these other images. And then the metaphor is there's also a kind of peripheral thinking of ideas circulating and gathering till the work starts. So the studio is both a physical space and it's a metaphoric space of how our head is working.
In the opening film of your series, Self-Portrait as a Coffee Pot, you say you start thinking you'll draw a whole picture of the universe but end up with a coffee pot. And there are many images of the coffee pot in your studio, a classic stovetop espresso type, large and small, in charcoal and ink. What is the coffee pot? I mean, what does it represent to you?
Well, I don't know what it represents, but the fact is that's the one kind of coffee I don't like drinking. And so those pots come into the studio and people see them in my pictures and think, oh, that's the pot I love, that's the coffee I love, and give me more of them. So there are a lot of them around, but there's something in it, the You know, they look like a woman in a skirt, the way it spreads out at the bottom, the way the mouth, the lid can open as if it's a voice shouting. So there are anthropomorphic elements that call to me. It's almost a puppet as well as a coffee pot. It's the different facets catch light in different ways. So it has different degrees of grey and black tonality in it. So it meets that criteria of meeting a drawing halfway. And then it becomes like a character in commedia dell'arte that's there in the studio as a possibility of an image to perform many different roles and many different things. But also it's saying that you can describe oneself, one could describe oneself through all the books you've ever read. The library and bookshelves in your house is a way of describing who you are, becomes a kind of self-portrait. And over the years, all the drawings you've done as an artist are another way of describing who you are. So they become a self-portrait in the third person as well. And so this coffee pot is an image which has come through a lot, and one could say that's a kind of self-portrait without ever thinking of it as a self-portrait. It's interesting if I think of it as a self-portrait because it's a very feminine object. So I think, all right, I'm happy to have a feminine self-portrait as one element of who I am.
The coffee pot is tied to a memory that you explore in the film of family picnics when you were young, featuring sardines, boiled eggs, and a thermos of coffee. It's not, is it sideways?
Yeah.
Into the coffee. But you engage in the film in a debate with yourself. I mean, literally, you're double over those childhood memories and whether it's possible to recall even the most intimate, distant events with any accuracy. And I just think, going back to this question of memory, is it something that engages you personally as well as culturally or historically?
It does. I mean, I'm now at an age of 67, where I suddenly think I can't remember someone's name, and I think, uh-oh, there we go, there goes the memory, this is the first step, it's going to start rolling down the hill faster and faster, hang on to it while I can. So yes, it has a personal element as well. And also, you know, the question of when is memory too much and when is it not enough? You know, people who are stuck in reliving a traumatic event forever, they're ones very aware of memory being too strong. And when things just disappear, when emotional responses fade, then one feels a sense of loss with the loss of memory. So it's a very narrow band of memory that we have to, in fact, live with, neither too much nor too little. But in general, I'm in favor of memory rather than amnesia. There are a lot of people who say politically the only hope for countries that have gone through civil wars is to have a massive national amnesia for at least two generations. So only in Spain now are they starting to talk about the Civil War as a public conversation, because it's been too painful up till now, many people have said. So some theorists say that was a necessary amnesia. Others say no, having that amnesia means you've just never discussed it and you haven't dealt with it, and the trauma just continues, is kicked down the road. In South Africa, where we spoke about what had happened under apartheid, as soon as apartheid ended, seemed to me a better way of dealing with it.
With the Truth and Reconciliation Commission?
Yes, with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Naturally, you're at the center of your film series about the studio self-portrait as a coffee pot. And most of the time, as you mentioned, there's not just one of you, but two or even three. You repeatedly argue with yourself, interrogate yourself, even in one instance, try to stop yourself from telling a dream. Why did you want to dramatize this internal process?
I think I needed to, why did I need, well, there was no, otherwise it stays entirely internal. And I think I wanted to show the split of the self inside the studio. That's part of you is watching the other person, being dissatisfied with yourself as the artist when you're the critic or when you're the viewer watching it. Partly because to make external the internal dialogues and arguments one does have, to show the processes of what happens in the studio. And that's an internal one. But through the process of filming double, it's possible to make it an external one. And that's what artists or studios do, make things which are normally invisible palpable and visible.
In the third film in the series, there's not just a lot of interaction between the different yous on the screen. There's even mirror play. And I couldn't help being reminded of the famous mirror scene with Groucho Marx from Duck Soup. Was that deliberate?
That was very deliberate. It was very much an homage to that brilliant piece in Duck Soup. And that second, you know, the sense of, is that a mirror or is that not? Of course, the Marx Brothers were fantastic physical clowns, so they could be much more ambiguous about keeping their actions almost the same, but not quite the same. But it became a way of saying, yes, there are the self, but the other self is not identical. So you may put your hands in your pocket, but your mirror reflection might say, well, I choose not to put my hands in my pockets. So it was an elaboration, another way of showing the split. And then how can one play? How does this game of being doubled and quadrupled in the mirror continue? What are the variations it can play through?
Because you do leave us kind of wanting to see where this relationship might go between your various selves.
Yes. In the final episode of the series, one of me stays in the studio and the other is fed up and leaves. But the one does stay in the studio. I'm not sure if that's how we'll finally end it, but that's how it ends at the moment.
William Kentridge, as we hear in the beautiful soundtrack of your film series, Self-Portrait as a Coffee Pot, music is very important to you. Do you use music for inspiration in the studio?
I listen to music badly in the studio. If I need to listen to it properly to think about it, then that's what I need to do, just to listen to it. But very often when drawing, there's music playing in the studio. But some of it gives an initial energy, but very often it becomes a kind of a screen to block out the sound of the office or the other people in the rooms around the studio. And at a certain point, you have to switch off and become conscious of it again. So it's not a good way of listening. So when I'm hunting for different kinds of sounds for different projects, I must probably do it either sitting at a desk so that I'm not trying to draw at the same time, or in the editing room with the editors where we look at an image and try many different pieces of music with it, or when talking to a composer where we'll be at a piano or in a studio doing it. So there's moments of very conscious, very clear engagement very deeply with what the music and image are doing, and there are times when it's much more a kind of background, imperfect, impure listening.
You've said that as a teenager you dreamed of becoming an orchestra conductor or even an opera conductor, but you couldn't read music. Your father loves opera. Is that where you got it from?
I'm sure that it is. I mean, both my parents loved opera, my father particularly, and he was the one who would choose records and buy records and play. So it was through gramophone records, vinyls, that I first knew opera. And then we had a small opera company in Johannesburg, so I saw some productions there, but for someone who's directed opera, I'm kind of an illiterate. The number of different operas I've seen is very low. There's not a functioning opera company in Johannesburg at all anymore. And in truth, I've done, I think, 6 operas in my life, not 6 a year, which a professional opera director might do. But I do love it. I love the fact that in opera, it's accepted, and this is rare in the Anglo-Saxon world, where emotions can be expressed directly, without irony. Love, hate, revenge, distress, all of these emotions are there directly, played out full by the music, expressed fully by, without apology, by the performers. And if you're embarrassed by strong emotion directly expressed, then opera is obviously not a form that one is sympathetic to. But I'm so relieved to have that after the self-ironizing of so many and of myself in so many ways in the world.
In recent decades, you've directed operas on the world's great stages, including Shostakovich's The Nose, Mozart's The Magic Flute, Berg's Lulu, and Wozzeck. The New York Times described your Magic Flute as an exuberant dialogue between drawing and music. And I wondered about the relationship between the two. Yes.
I mean, the relationship between an image and what we hear is obviously something that I've been engaged with since the first piece of film I worked at that had sound to it. And with each of the operas, it's been important to find a visual language in which to think about it. So you need to have a theme that you're interested in, whether it's about desire in Lulu or desperation in Wozzeck or the enlightenment in the Magic Flute or the absurd in the Nose, and then to find a visual language with which to think about it. Charcoal drawing in the one, the paper cutout animation in the Nose, and in torn up ink drawings in Lulu. And that is always the question. How does what you see affect what you hear, and what you hear affect what you see, both in the animated films but also on the stage. So the operas are always a treat to work with. There's the constraint, of course, of the libretto and the particular music, but within that there's an enormous space for the opera to turn into this large drawing.
I think you once described it as, like, you know, we'll give you a canvas 17 meters wide, 11 meters high, another 18 meters of depth, and you get to make an hour and a half drawing in the space. I mean, it's, I imagine it must be both daunting and extraordinarily...
It is both. I mean, one can either think of oneself as the hired hand who's there to direct the opera, and the conductor to direct, you know, to conduct it and so on, or as you described, thinking of this extraordinary opportunity that's been given to you by this generous opera house of the musicians, the all thrown to help this drawing that's going to move across the stage over 2 hours or 3 hours to come to life. And then it's a remarkably generous gift given to the artist to do that.
To go back to South Africa for a moment, you established the Center for the Less Good Idea in Johannesburg in 2016 as a place for experimentation, a kind of incubator for performers. What can you tell me what goes on there? What kinds of projects you've had?
The Center for the Less Good Idea, the name comes from a Tswana, an African proverb, which says, if the good doctor can't cure you, find the less good doctor. In other words, if the grand, huge ideas in the world aren't working, find things from the periphery, find other ways of thinking about the world. So what happens is we invite different curators and musicians and video makers and dancers, all different people, to come together to work on projects. Some of the projects are known in advance by the participants. Some are invented on the spot. But the principle of it is being alert and aware to things that emerge in rehearsal, in the sound studio, as a way of shaping and changing what necessarily the first impulse of the idea was. So we've privileged short-form pieces. So every year we have one or two seasons of showing what's been made in the centre. So over these 6 years, I think there have been 700 different participants, actors, dancers, musicians in the centre. And we've had 9 seasons of different projects, which are also seen in different parts of the world. Some of them are long in Los Angeles. A month ago we had a production of Houseboy, which is a 2-hour long theatre production. And in the Barbican in London 2 months ago, we had a series of 10-minute performances, different 10-minute performances, different directors, different actors. I'm sometimes a director of one. I've once been a curator, but generally I'm, you know, it's other directors and other curators. And it's become an enormously rich place for people to work in. The fact that it's not about having something that becomes immediately commercially viable as an hour and a half piece. The fact that one doesn't first have to write the grant proposal before doing the piece. That you don't have to make it before you make it. You can see how it emerges in front of you. And some of the pieces obviously don't hold together. Some of them are just less good ideas. But some of the less good ideas produce very beautiful pieces. Sometimes visual, very usually performance of one form or another.
I wondered if there is an element in which it's inspired by your own experiments with different kinds of artistic practices and careers.
The Center came out very much about, you know, the pleasure and excitement I've had in a lot of the collaborations, working in the theatre project with the puppet company, Handspring Puppet Company, working on the operas with designers, with the conductors, and wanting to make that available and show that way of working, which is difficult unless you have those connections or have invitations to do that kind of work, even in Johannesburg, where, as I said, there are lots of different people who are happy to work together. And so it was very much came out of the confidence I'd had from years of working, of giving the images the benefit of the doubt, of understanding that best ideas are often what comes through the work rather than something you've thought of before you started. Like the example of the erasure and animation that we talked about earlier.
It's a pleasure to have the chance to talk to you again. Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure for me. Thank you so much.
South African artist William Kentridge speaking to me from the studio at his home in Johannesburg. The exhibition William Kentridge, In Praise of Shadows, is at the Broad Museum in Los Angeles until April 9th. A detailed illustrated catalog is published by the Broad and Delmonico Books. There's also a book of his theatrical production, The Head and the Load. And his Norton Lectures, titled Six Drawing Lessons, is published by Harvard University Press. Writers and Company is produced by Sandra Rabinovich, our senior producer. The associate producer is Melissa Gismondi. I'm Eleanor Wachtel. Next week from Glasgow, novelist Graham McRae Burnett. His entertaining fiction eludes labels and explores not-so-true crimes with a psychological bent. That's next week. I hope you'll join me.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.